Just a second. Okay, there we go. I want to begin by asking you a question today, and that is, what would you say are the top 10 events in human history? What would you think of the top 10 events in human history? Well, I made a little list of what I would say would be the top 10, and I'm going to give you not in terms of their rank, the most outstanding event, the next most, but in historical order. See what you think of my list. The first one I'd put down is Adam and Eve's rejection of God. Now, you could say, well, what about creation? Well, that was really technically before human events, before humans. So you can't quite include that, but I'd say that that would be the one. The flood would be another. Abraham's calling and God's promises would be another one. The Exodus. The collapse of Israel and Judah. The rise of Babylon and the great successive resurrections of that kingdom. Christ's life and sacrifice. The spread of the gospel. The fulfillment of the prophecies to Abraham, which many of those have occurred. And the moral collapse of civilization that we seem to be in the process of. Would list Christ's second coming, but that's not happened yet. That's in the future. So here's my list. You might be able to think of some others and so forth, but these are in you might say, historical order. But looking at the list, what would you say would be the number one, the top event in human history? I suspect that most of you would pick number seven, Christ's life and sacrifice. That's up there, isn't it? And probably wouldn't be much debate about that. But what about number two? What would you say is number two? The second most influential or important event in human history. And we might get a little bit of debate on number two that you wouldn't get on number one. But I suggest to you that a good case can be made that the second most important event in human history is the Exodus. A case can be made for that. For example, how many books of the Bible are basically dedicated towards the Exodus and surrounding events? Just four. Right. A little bit of Genesis is, but, you know, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. That's all pretty much about the Exodus and the related events. Four books. What other event is the four books dedicated to? Well, how about the life of Christ? Certainly there are four books there. So, but you see, that's kind of right up there with the life of Christ, the Exodus. A lot of time is dedicated to it. But another thing I did in a search, I said, okay, well, let's set aside the first five books of the Bible. And let's look at the Old Testament from Judges to Malachi. The Old Testament, excluding the first five books, which obviously talk a lot about the Exodus. How many times is the Exodus referenced in those books? Well, I counted 56 mentions of the Exodus, and each of these 56 was in this regard, that learn from the lessons of the Exodus. That was the context of what each of these references to the Exodus was, that we should be learning from the events of the Exodus. So that's a lot. In the New Testament, the Exodus in that context is mentioned six times. You know, so it carries over to the New Testament. Probably, and I didn't do a search on this, but probably the only Christ's life and sacrifice is mentioned more times after the fact than the Exodus is in the Bible. You know, after the fact, meaning after the Gospels, Acts through Revelation. Probably Christ is mentioned more than the Exodus. So I think there's a pretty good case there for the importance of the Exodus. And yet, interestingly, a lot of people don't believe there was an Exodus. Matter of fact, the people that count in the world, which are the historians, the archaeologists, the scientists that study these sort of things, most of them don't believe there was an Exodus. They can't find any evidence. You know, Egypt left a ton of stuff. Ton of stuff, carvings, tablets, and monuments and so forth about the history of Egypt. And it doesn't seem that they mentioned the Exodus at all. Pretty big event. But Egyptian history and archaeology are mum on the Exodus. And other than the Bible, so is history and archaeology of Israel, of all the other surrounding countries in the Middle East. Not much there. And scientists and historians and archaeologists, they've concluded not likely that there was an Exodus. As Mr. Sandilands told you, I'd be talking some about the Exodus, so this is my way of working myself into the topic. But the first thing I want to do is give you a title for the sermon. And I do this as a favor to Jonah. Well, maybe Josh, too. You know, they look kind of alike. but it's his responsibility to put a title to load up when we load the sermon up on the website. And, you know, Jonah being as kind of slow as he is, I want to make sure he gets this title right and just doesn't make up some strange title. So get your pencil out, Jonah. Take this down carefully. And here's the title to my sermon. You got it all? Okay, good. Since I'm talking about the Exodus, and Exodus has to do with Egypt, and since I'm sure all of you are fairly familiar with hieroglyphics, that I thought it would be appropriate to give the notes on this sermon in hieroglyphics. But I sense with a puzzlement there that there are one or two that maybe aren't quite fluent in hieroglyphics yet, and so let me translate that for you. The Bible, archaeology, and the Exodus. And by the way, this will be the first part of several sermons that we will go through to talk about the Exodus. Now, I want to thank Terry Croft. Some time ago, this is six, 8 months ago, she gave me a video entitled Patterns of Evidence that was produced by Michael Medved. And that talked about the Exodus and the dates of the Exodus and why we don't find much evidence of it in archaeology and that sort of thing. But then a while back, our ministerial journal, the Kagwa Ministerial Journal, that's sent out three times a year to the ministry, had a book review of a book called Pharaohs and Kings by David Roll, who's an archaeologist. And he questioned a lot of things that science and historians and other archaeologists are saying about the times of the Exodus and why we don't find any evidence of the Exodus. And the gist of that is that that we're looking in the wrong places, and I'll get into that some. But anyway, you know, it's interesting, the hieroglyphics. Up until the 1800s, there was all this stuff in Egypt written in hieroglyphics. Tons of stuff. And nobody could figure it out. Until they found the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone had this decree written in three different scripts and in two different languages, Egyptian and Greek. And it's the same decree, and that finally unlocked the key to the hieroglyphics. Many thought it was each of these pictures meant something. Some thought it was alphabet. Some thought it was just some kind of strange code. Turns out it's basically an alphabet. You know, like looking at the first word here, the, these first two symbols are the sound, TH sound, the. And this falcon is the ah sound. So the is the first word. Then the foot, that's a foot there. In the second word, B, and that palm leaf is a Y or an I, and then another B, by, but, and then this is, that's supposed to be an arm with the hand reaching out, but that's a kind of a eh, by, bell. And they don't have an L in the alphabet, so they had to have to use some other sounds, and so, but they also combine constants, and they have pairs of constants, and every now and then they use pictograms, so it's kind of complicated, but you can read it, and so this is how the the phrases of the title of my sermon, excuse me, are. Now, the what I want, oops, hold on a second here. What I want to do first is to give you a few quotes from the scientists, from the archaeologists, from religious leaders that relates to the historical evidence of the Exodus. This first one's from Israel Finkelstein, an archaeologist at Tel Aviv University. Now, there's somebody that should have a good grip on the Exodus. The quote is, "Exodus did not happen in the way it is described in the text, based on the background of the 15th century B.C. I said, it doesn't happen the way it's described in the Bible. Then Norma Franklin, an archaeologist at the University of Haifa, she writes, "I don't believe that there was a single event that we can call the Exodus, archaeologically or historically." And then there's the Egyptologist, Kent Weeks, and he said this, "How can you prove that Ramses II was the pharaoh of the Exodus? Chronology of Egypt is a bit ambiguous." That's a little understatement. "Correlations between Egyptian chronology and other cultures is even more confusing. We don't know when the Exodus happened. We almost any pharaoh could be the pharaoh of the Exodus if we could prove that there was an Exodus." But of this series of quotes, this is my favorite, from Rabbi David Wolpe, a leader of one of the largest Jewish congregations in the country out in the West Coast. He says, "The Exodus certainly didn't happen the way the Bible depicted it, assuming that it was a historical event in any description. I think that if you look at the at it scientifically, it's virtually indefensible to make the Bible's case. But you also have to understand that your faith isn't based on splitting seas or archaeological digs. It is based on something much deeper." And then he goes on to say, "The extent to which it has been an historical core is very hard to say. But my deeper conviction about it is that it's a story that, whether it was true, it is true. And those are two different things." Let me read that again. My deeper conviction about it is that it is a story that, whether it was true, it is true. And those are two different things. In other words, things that aren't facts can be truths. You know what that sounds? That sounds like modern thinking of millenniums. No offense to any millenniums in the audience. If there's no physical, could it be? Could it be the Bible is just kind of a myth? You know, like myths in all religious, ancient religions, there's all these myths and so forth. Could it be that it really didn't happen? Shouldn't there be some evidence of an event of this nature? You know, if, in general, I could give a whole sermon on just these kind of quotes of scientists, archaeologists, historians who don't believe there was an Exodus. Most of the scientific world don't believe the Exodus actually happened. But if the Exodus didn't happen, then doesn't that make the Bible false? And if the Bible is false, doesn't that make the God of the Bible false? And if the Bible and that God is false, doesn't that make the Ten Commandments of no effect? See, the Exodus is a proof of the Bible. The Exodus is a proof of God. And if you can't prove it and show that it was a historical event, then, well, is the Bible the Word of God? You have to ask yourselves. Well, that's what I want to get into today. I want to answer these skeptics and present some evidence of the Exodus, which brings us to some questions. And so let me put up some of these questions that we need to look at. Here's the first question. Oh, whoops, I forgot to translate this one for you. Was Israel in Egypt? You know, there's one question that we have to ask. Was Israel in Egypt? Is the Joseph story true? Were there plagues in Egypt? Did a Moses lead the Exodus? What kind of evidence should we look for to prove the Exodus? Is the Exodus story really significant to us today? Now, to get into all this, what I suggest we need is we need some kind of checklist that we can go through to prove the Exodus. And so here's my checklist that I'm going to throw up here for you. Now, one of the things it'd be nice to know was a biblical date for the Exodus. And related to that, a biblical date for the sojourn, the time from Jacob to Moses and the Exodus. And what we would need then, if we can get those dates, if we had a consistent Egyptian chronology of the pharaohs for the Exodus, we could look and say, okay, which were the pharaohs of Joseph's time, which was the pharaoh of the Exodus, and that would kind of give us a place to look for evidence of the Exodus. We need to look for evidence of a widespread famine in the Middle East during that time. You'd think there'd be some evidence of that. You'd need to see if you can find any remains of Hebrews in Goshen. That's where most of them lived. You'd need a relatively signs of a relatively weak pharaoh who consolidates his power after the famine that led to Joseph's rise to power. Now, that may not be obvious to you, but the Bible points out something, and we'll get into that somewhat later, that relates to this: what happened during the famine that led to a strengthening of the throne in Egypt. We need an evidence of a sudden disappearance of the Hebrews. Poof, they're suddenly gone. We need some evidence of that. And then we need evidence of a following collapse of Egypt leading to an extended period of chaos and confusion. Egypt was devastated after all the plagues and the Exodus. And so we'd need to see some evidence of that. And then once the Exodus occurred 40 years later, the Israelites move into Canaan. And so we'd need some evidence of the destruction of Canaanite cities in Israel, like Jericho, for example. And then evidence of a rise of a new Egypt that could be powerful again and make excursions into Judah and Israel and command that power that it once had. So we'd need all those kinds of things. But particularly, I mentioned the collapse of Egypt here. You think about just how bad that was. in that, you know, starting with the water to blood, the Bible states that the fish died, then the frogs, and they all died and stank, and then we started getting rotting corpses, and you started getting disease, bacteria, and those sorts of things fermenting. Then came the lice that was on animals and men, and that just led to scratching and open wounds and things like that. And then all the livestock in the field died. And then the boils, it just got worse. You know, boils, pus, and all that kind of stuff. And then the hail. Now the hail, this was in the spring, early spring more than likely, where the early crops were about to be harvested. And so the hail destroyed the barley, the early crops. And then, and trees and so forth. Then the locust came, and whatever was left, the locust ate. And after the plague of the locust, I won't throw this scripture up there, I'll just repeat it. In Exodus 10:7, after the plague of the locust, the advisors to the Pharaoh said, to Pharaoh, do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? That's what the advisors were telling the Pharaoh after the plague of the locusts. Then, of course, there was the 3 days of darkness, must have been scary, and then the death of the firstborn. And then later on, the destruction of Pharaoh's army. What was left of Egypt after all that? There should be some evidence of that, should there not? Well, we're going to see if we can find some. But what I want to focus today is on the first two of my checklist, the biblical date for the Exodus and the biblical date for the sojourn. I want to start there and see if we can pin that down. So let's start there. Now, how do you... You know, those dumb Egyptians and those dumb Israelites did not use our calendar. They hadn't invented our calendar yet. You know, it started out in Roman times, the Julian calendar, which then evolved into the Gregorian calendar. Pre-BC, there was no calendars. And even when they did come up with some kind of calendar, they had it wrong. You know? So how do you go back to 2000 BC, to 1500 BC, to 1000 BC, and try to say, oh, well, this must have been on this date, according to our modern calendar? How do you do that? You know, that's something that's not easy. But we do, and so here's the way that archaeologists and historians do this. They look for something that they often refer to as pillars for dating any historical events, not just biblical events, but we're going to talk specifically here about dating the biblical Exodus. Look for pillars, in other words, undisputable evidence from history that we can lock into and come up with a modern calendar date for something that happened thousands of years ago. All right, so let's look at what they are. And the first one doesn't have anything to do with the Bible. And I mentioned this in my last sermon, talking about Egypt, the sacking of Thebes in 664 BC. The sacking of Thebes. Now, science, archaeology, historians all look to the date of the sacking of Thebes as a pillar for dating anything in the ancient Middle East. Why? Well, it's supported by what you might say is a network of interlocking sources. Now, you might recall, remember that map I showed you, Syria was just a little dot up around Nineveh, and it kind of grew and grew and took over all of Babylon, Syria, right on down until finally it took over all of Egypt, all the way down to Thebes. Which means that practically every country in the whole Middle East, often referred to in the literature these days as the Levant, throughout the entire Levant, every kingdom was involved with fighting Assyria and kept records about what was going on as Assyria conquered one land after another. And so there's a bunch of sources. There's a Greek historian called Manetho, who was in the 6th century B.C. And he had information and sources that have been lost since the 6th century B.C., but that was one source. And then there's a number of the Assyrian and Babylonian chronicles that provide information that helps tie down that date. There's things like in Egypt, the Apis Stella. The Apis Stella. That's a place that no longer exists, but at one time it was, a city that kept all the records of Egypt and that sort of thing. And it also had a temple there. And there was a thing called, the Egyptians worshipped a lot of things, but one thing they worshipped was a bull. And the bull had to have very specific markings on his face, on his shoulders, on his hindquarters, and they're called the Apis bulls. And once they found this first Apis bull, he was a god. And he would reside in the Apis bull temple. And people would come and worship and ask the Apis bull to help them provide things for them and so forth. And the Apis bull would be decorated. But bulls don't live forever. And so, as a matter of fact, the average life of an Apis bull, they believe, was about 18 years. And so when the Apis bull died, then they'd scour Egypt to find another calf with the same markings. And that would become the next Apis bull. Now, what do they do with the old Apis bull? Fry up some steaks? No, they buried him in a temple dedicated to the Apis bulls. And so somewhere along the way, archaeologists found the tomb of these Apis bulls. And they're in order, and they kept track of the first Apis bull. Was this it? Lived this long? The next? And it was carved in the stones around the tomb, all these Apis bulls. And so it's things like this that are used to come up with, well, when did the sacking of Thebes occur by the Assyrians? And then, of course, there's the Egyptian, what they refer to as the Egyptian regnal dates. In other words, the reign of the pharaohs. See, they didn't say, well, in this date, this pharaoh took office. They did the same thing we see in the Bible with the kings of Israel and Judah. In the first year of this king, or the fourth year of this king of Israel, this king of Judah began his reign. And in the 10th year of this king of Judah, this king of Israel began his reign. And so the Egyptians did the same thing. They would give the pharaohs an order. But sometimes things were lost. Sometimes Egyptians had a bad habit, too. Later on, another dynasty of pharaohs came along. They would scrape off the carvings of the temple of a previous dynasty and then start using it for their own. And so, you know, so there's some things that you can't get. But more than any other nation in ancient history, the Egyptians left a lot of information, a ton of information. All right, so anyway, everybody agrees the sacking of Thebes occurred in about 664, let's say plus or minus 2 years. That's how close they feel they are to that. And nobody disputes that. So that's become one of the pillars for dating anything. So let's use it for dating the biblical Exodus. Now, the second pillar is the biblical chronology of the kings of the divided kingdom put together by a man by the name of Edward Thiel. And he did this back in 1951. And, this king of Judah became king in the fourth year. You can go through and kind of try to match these things up and get a lineage of all the kings of Israel and Judah and back it right on up to Saul. But there's some problems there because sometimes there was a co-regency in either Israel or Judah. One king might be getting old. Take Uriah. He got leprosy for the rest of his life. So his son appears to have taken over towards the latter part of Uriah's reign, but he didn't become king until Uzziah. Get my us mixed up here. Uzziah, when he died, was when his son officially became king, but he had been basically ruling for years before that. And so this is what Edward Thiel did, is he put this together, but also because of the interaction between the Assyrians and Israel and Judah, there's a lot of cross-references in the Assyrian annals. And this helped kind of tighten up this chronology that Edward Thiel developed. And so we think we have a pretty good idea of the dates of all the kings of Israel and Judah. And so this is the second pillar. And not just using it to date Bible things, but they actually use this pillar to date other things outside the Bible. This scientists, archaeologists, this is one of their pillars that they use for all their dating. All right, but then the third thing is 1 Kings 6:1. The biblical statement that the Exodus occurred 430 years before the fourth year of Solomon's reign. So let's look at that 1 Kings 6:1. Because these are the three things that we're going to use to date the Exodus. 1 Kings 6:1, and it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. And that sounds pretty exact, doesn't it? It doesn't say, well, about 400 years ago, give or take 20 years. It's very precise here. Like the writer knew what he was talking about. And since we accept the Bible as the Word of God, let's accept that that's what happened. The Exodus occurred 480 years from the fourth year of Solomon's reign. Now, as I mentioned, those three pillars that I listed, archaeologists accept pillar one, sacking of Thebes. They pretty much accept pillar two, the chronology of the kings of Israel and Judah. But they reject this one. And they substitute it with another one that I'll talk about later. But let's use this pillar since it's in the Bible and see how it works. Now, according to the chronology that Edward Thiel developed, the first year of Solomon's reign would have been around 971. Now, again, probably most people think that at most this could be maybe plus or minus 2 years. For example, Halley's Handbook. You might look in there and it gives 973. And so you see slightly different dates, but they're all pretty close. And so there's fairly general agreement of around 971 was the first year of Solomon's reign. All right, so if we go to the fourth year of Solomon's reign, we need to subtract 4 years from 971. Remember, B.C., when we advance forward in time, the years get smaller. So we have to subtract 4 years off of 971, which, if my math is correct, that would be 967. And then we have to add on, in the past, 480 years. So we add on that, and we're back to the Exodus. And if we tally that up, we get the year of the Exodus as 1447 B.C. Now, according to the Bible, two of these things come from basically the Bible. The other comes from the sacking of Thebes, to pin this down. So we have then a fairly good date for the Exodus, give or take a couple of years, either way. Maybe it's 1446, maybe it's 1448 or so, but we're pretty close, really close in for historical times of that far back. And that's what's generally believed. Now, there's another way of somewhat collaborating this date. Let me show you that one. It's in Judges. Jephthah was an outcast recruited to defend Gilead against Ammon. And so he first pursues some peace talks with them, and he gives a little history. And this is what we are here in Judges 11, verses 16 through 18. He gives a little history lesson to the people he's talking to, trying to seek peace, the Ammonites. For when Israel came up from Egypt, they walked through the wilderness as far as the Red Sea and came to Kadesh. Then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, "Please let me pass through your land." But the king of Edom would not heed. And in the like manner, they sent to the king of Moab, but he would not consent. And so Israel remained in Kadesh. And they went along through the wilderness and bypassed the land of Edom and the land of Moab and came to the east side of the land of Moab and encamped on the other side of the Arnon. That's a river. But they did not enter the border of Moab, for Arnon was the border of Moab. So here's what we see here. Can you see that? Well, that's not too good from up here. But not too good. It's a little small. I'm going to blow it up a little bit in just a minute. But as a matter of fact, let me do that now. That's a little better. Right down here is the Dead Sea. Up here is the Sea of Galilee. So we have Edom, Moab, Ammon. Here is Jahaz, the city right here. Here is Heshbon right here. The Arnon River runs right down through here. This is the Arnon River. So the Israelites were camped right over here. Okay? That's where they were camped. And as Jephthah relates it. And so what happens? Matter of fact, we're going to be looking right at that area up there in the next verse, Judges 11, verse 19 through 21. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, king of Heshbon, and Israel said to him, "Please let us pass through your land into our place." But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together and encamped in Jahaz and fought against Israel. And the Lord God of Israel delivered Sihon and all of his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated him. And thus Israel gained possession of all the land of the Amorites who inhabited the country. So there was a big battle there at this point. Bring that right up. You know, there's a big battle, and here we are, Jahaz right here. And that Jericho's right over here. That left the path coming into Israel open. And so continuing on down in Judges 11, 26. And while Israel dwelt in Heshbon and its villages in Aora and its villages and in all the cities along the banks of the Arnon for 300 years, why did you not recover them then? So basically what Jephthah is saying is, we've been living here for 300 years since the Israelites entered into Canaan. We've been, and now you want 300 years later, now you want it? Yeah. It's kind of like the Indians saying, "Hey, give us back this country. We've only had it for 300 or 400 years." And you want it back? Well, that's what that was what the issue was then, but he gives us a round number, you know, 300 years. That's probably not to the day or to the year. That sort of thing. But it does give us another time frame that we could look back and see, is this consistent with the dates of the Exodus? And so the question is, well, when was Jephthah raining. And we're not sure to the extent we are some of these other kings, so forth, later on. But the historians believe that it was between around 1130 and 1110 B.C., somewhere in that range. And so I picked 1120 as just a round number that's kind of halfway between the high and the low that historians think he might have reigned there. So let's take the the number of 1120. And we add 300 years to that. We should be getting to around the time that the Israelites came into Canaan. And we have to add another 40 years to that. We should be getting around the time of the Exodus. And that comes out to 1460. Remember, the other number was 1447. That's 13 years off. So this is a little shakier number because it's, we're not nearly as sure about when Jephthah reigned, but it shows we're in the ballpark here fairly closely at this time. Yeah, so let's go back to our checklist. We can check off a biblical date for the Exodus. And now what about a date for the sojourn? Let's look at that. Date for the sojourn in Egypt. Let's go back to Exodus 12 and verse 40 and 41 to start there. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Okay, so there's a time frame. This is the New King James Version. However, the translation here is in question. Not the number, but something else. The Septuagint was an earlier translation from earlier sources of the Bible than the later King James, New King James Version. So the Septuagint goes back earlier. And here's what the Septuagint says. Exodus 12:40, and the sojourning of the children of Israel, that is, that they sojourned in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, was 430 years. Ah. So we have one source that says from Abraham's entry into Canaan to the Exodus was 430 years. And another source that seems to say, no, from Jacob's entrance into Egypt to the Exodus was 430 years. So we have kind of some conflicting evidence here. Now, Josephus, let's look and see what Josephus says. In his Antiquities of the Jews, chapter 15, 2, Josephus wrote, they left Egypt in the month of Xantiochus, on the 15th day of the lunar month, 430 years after our forefather Abraham came into Canaan, but 215 years only after Jacob removed into Egypt. So Josephus said, yes, 430 years, but 215 are from Abraham to Jacob coming into Egypt, and then another 215 in Egypt. So we have a little bit of a conflict here, you might say, of the different translations. But let's look at Galatians 3 and verses 16 and 17. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say to seeds, plural, as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ. And this I say, that the law, which was 430 years later, okay, so from Abraham coming into Canaan and receiving this promise, which was be early when Abraham came to Canaan, to the law, which was right after the Exodus, Paul says that was 430 years. So the evidence seems to indicate that the sojourn included Abraham's time to the Exodus was 430 years. Now, there's one other scripture that we need to look at, and that's Genesis 15, beginning in verse 13. Because now, here, God is telling Abraham about the future and referring to the Exodus. Then he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age, but in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." Now he's kind of talking in round numbers here. 400 years. He calls the fourth generation. Sounds like he's talking about 100 years per generation here. But what this is saying here, the way this is phrased, you know, you will serve them, and they will and will afflict them 400 years. It's almost as if he's saying, well, they'll be afflicted from now to 400 years from now. You know, it could be kind of translated that way or read that way. And so it's not clear, but most of the evidence seems to indicate that the time of the sojourn was 215 years, and then the time from Abraham to Jacob coming into Egypt was 215 years. Now, this is not a critical thing, but there is a little bit of confusion there. Now, why is it important to kind of pin this down? It's because if we want to know who the Pharaoh was of the Exodus and who the Pharaoh was of Joseph, we kind of need to know some dates here, and then we can look at Egyptian chronology and see how they match up. And that's what I want to do later on in the next sermon, as a matter of fact. But what I want to look at here is looking at what we can come from just from looking at the Bible itself in terms of Abraham down to Joseph and down to the Exodus, actually. And so, you know, what you can do, and you can sit down and go through this period, and mainly most of these scriptures come from Genesis, where they talk about when Abraham came in to the land of Canaan, when Isaac was born, when Jacob was born, when Joseph was born, you know, all these kind of things. They describe those. And so I've kind of outlined it here. In the second column, this is from the birth of Abraham. Year zero in the second column is from birth of Abraham. He came into Egypt, left Haran, and came into Egypt when he was 75. He passed on through Canaan, went into Egypt for a little while, then came back. We don't know the date of that. But we do know that Isaac was born when Abraham was 100, from Genesis 21:5. And we know that Jacob was born when Isaac was 60, which would mean that would be 160 years from Abraham's birth. And then we know Abraham dies at 175. And Joseph was born when Abraham was about 87. I didn't give a scripture there, but if you read through that section, it's maybe off a year or two, but something like that. And then Joseph was taken into Egypt when he was around 17, 18. You know, the coat of many colors he got when he was 17. And then he was packed off by his brothers as a slave. It could have been 17. There might have been a little time period in there. It might have been 18 by the time he actually was carried off to Egypt, but somewhere in there. So that's about the best we get. So I used 18 here in my calculations. But now Joseph became the vizier of Egypt, Genesis 41:46, when he was 30. That gets us down 277 years from Abraham's birth. And then Isaac dies at 180. Jacob goes into Egypt when he's 130. You can track these things down. And Joseph dies when he's 110. That gets us down to 357 years from Abraham's birth. And then from all this genealogy given in Genesis, what we don't know is from Joseph to Moses, this little gap right here. That gap we can't figure out from Genesis, okay? Unless we use the total of 430 years from the time that Abraham came into Canaan till the time of the Exodus. And if we pull that in now, that gives us a date that Moses was born around 425 years after Abraham was born. And the Exodus was 505 years after Abraham was born. Now, since we know the day of the Exodus was around 1447 in this first column, we can now backtrack and come up to when Jacob goes into Egypt was around 1662. And 1877, these are all B.C., of course, was when Abraham came in to the land of Canaan. Okay, so we can kind of get an idea. Let me go to another slide here that simplifies this. And maybe a little easier to read, too. That Abraham's entrance into Canaan, 1877. Jacob's entrance into Egypt, 1662. And the Exodus, 1447. Now, this gives us a way, the 1662 gives us a way to determine who was the Pharaoh during the time of Joseph. The 1447 gives us a way of determining who was the Pharaoh in the time of Exodus. And, of course, if you want to know who was the Pharaoh in the time of Abraham's entrance into Canaan, we could also look at that, too. If we have a nice Egyptian chronology of everything, then the only thing this would change if that 430 debate I was talking about is different, is that it would slide Abraham's entrance into Canaan and Jacob's entrance into Egypt further earlier. But it wouldn't affect the date of the Exodus. But everything seems to indicate that it probably was that the 215 years in Canaan, 215 years in Egypt, appears to be what it should be. Now what? Let me go back to our checklist here. We can check off a date for the sojourn. Now, let's kind of begin to talk a little bit about Egyptian chronology. I'm not going to talk a lot about that today. We'll save that for next Sabbath. I will be speaking next Sabbath. Mr. Sanderlin was scheduled to speak next Sabbath, but he's been asked to go over to Mobile next Sabbath and speak there. And so I said, well, I've got plenty of dates I can throw out next Sabbath. So I'll take the sermon next Sabbath. But what archaeologists, historians do is they reject this date in 1 Kings 6:1 that gives us 1447. They throw that out. Now, that's just myth. And they use something else. They use the first two. They like the chronicles of the kings of Israel and Judah. They like the sacking of Thebes date. But they don't like 1 Chronicles 6:1. What they like is something else. It has to do with Shishak. And, you know, the Egyptian chronology is tied to the assumption that the Pharaoh Shoshink was the Shishak mentioned in the Bible that came in to the Pharaoh that came in and invaded Israel. So that's what they say. And they use that to link all the dates of the Egyptian chronology. So let's look at that. See, first of all, I'm going to get into all the chronology in more detail later, but we need to answer this question from the Bible. Was Ramses II the Pharaoh of the Exodus? And that's dumb. Everybody knows it because Cecil B. DeMille said so. And where'd he get it? Yeah, from the Bible. Maybe. Maybe not. That's what we're going to look at. And so what I want to do is, you know, first of all, they didn't know how to read hieroglyphs until the 1800s. And everybody got all excited. And, of course, back at that time, believe it or not, most archaeologists, most scientists, most people, at least in Europe, believed in the Bible. And so they were looking for evidence of the Exodus in a positive sense. You know, they believed the Bible, and so they were looking for evidence. And they found a lot about Ramses II, also called Ramses the Great. He had temples all over the place. He had temples in southern Egypt. He had temples down. Well, there's three. There's northern Egypt centered around Thebes. Then there's southern Egypt centered around. Northern Egypt centered around Memphis and Goshen, that area. Southern Egypt centered around Thebes, and then way, way down south, Aswan, where the Aswan Dam, famous Aswan Dam is. That is Egypt's border extended almost that far. Well, all the way from Aswan to Thebes, all the way up north to Memphis and Goshen, Ramses II built temples, palaces, all kinds of stuff. Very well known. and so they just accepted, Ramses was the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Why? Well, they did a reading of the Exodus, book of Exodus, like 12:37, Exodus 12:37. The children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides children. Okay, so there it is. We found the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Or is that what it really says? It says they journeyed from Ramses. They didn't say Ramses was the Pharaoh. There was a city of Ramses in Goshen. And they journeyed from that. Numbers 33, verse 3. They departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the day after the Passover. The children of Israel went out with boldness in sight of all the Egyptians. Verse 5, then the children of Israel moved from Ramses and camped at Succoth. So, that sounds kind of convincing. and so these early archaeologists, okay, well, this kind of ties in Ramses. Then he must have been, if he wasn't the Pharaoh of the Exodus, it must have been pretty close to him. And so that brings us to a fourth point here, is that Israel built the city of Ramses. At least that's what they interpreted this. Let's look at Exodus 1 and verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for the Pharaoh supply cities of Pithom and Ramses. Now it doesn't say they built great temples. It doesn't say they built palaces. It said they built supply cities. Why did they need supplies? Well, they had the Egyptians had figured out that it's a good idea to store up grain for the bad years, and so in the latter times, the people, this was more than likely after they became slaves, they were building these supply cities. Now, so this is the scriptures that led people to say, yeah, it must have been Ramses II, Ramses the Great. Maybe his son. Yeah, maybe it's a little bit after him, but right in that range. which was the 19th dynasty of Egypt, by the way. But things don't quite add up when you look at it carefully. Now, Joseph was in Egypt even earlier. And yet the land of Ramesses is listed. The scholars believe that the Old Testament was compiled basically around the 6th century B.C. Now, one thing we do know is that there was some editing of the Old Testament. Every now and then you'll read a passage in the Old Testament that may be talking about a certain location or a certain landmark or something like that, and it will say, and it's still there to this day. You see that several times in the Old Testament. Now, what is likely to have happened is the city of Ramesses was built during the early part of Ramesses' reign on top of an older city called Avaris. And Avaris, and I'm going to show you the excavation evidence of that next time. Avaris was the old city where the Hebrews settled. And by the time that this was later being compiled, Avaris was gone. The city of Ramesses was sitting on top of it with all its temples and grandeur. And so it's likely that the writers say, if they say Avaris, nobody's going to know where Avaris is. So we better pinpoint it down to the modern city at the time that this was edited of Ramesses. Now, see, as I've said, the conventional dates, well, I didn't say this yet, but the conventional, see, here's the discrepancies. The conventional dates for Ramesses was 1279 to 1213. That's the conventional dates that scholars have come up for the reign of Ramesses the Great. Exodus, 1447. Whoa, we're off a lot if we believe the biblical date rather than the date the scholars have come up for the rule of Ramesses the Great. But the scholars, when they came up with this date, rejected 1 Kings 6:1, the 480 years, and substituted something else in its place that tied down Ramesses' rule to 1279 to 1213. Okay, so that's a big problem. Oops, let me go back. I didn't talk about the second one. Then Joseph settled in the land of Ramesses hundreds of years before this city or Ramesses existed. Look at Genesis 47, verse 11. And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. All right, now, either Ramesses the Great lived 250, 300 years. Or, both these things can't be true. What is obviously going on here is that the editors have replaced Avaris, which was the original city that was now buried, and on top of it was these magnificent palaces and so forth of Ramesses, that they were referring to the city of Ramesses because that's what was there. And if somebody said Avaris, nobody would know what they were talking about because it had been gone for hundreds of years. And so we've got some discrepancies between what the Bible says the Exodus should be, 1447, what the archaeologists say was the reign of Ramesses II, 1200s. Big difference there. So what's going on? All right, now, here's the third discrepancy. the Israel Stela. You know, Stela is just this kind of a monument, kind of like a big tombstone kind of thing, that has inscriptions on it. And there's an Israel Stela found in Egypt that describes a war between Egypt and the Canaanite cities during Ramses' son's reign. Now, so this is dated to Ramses' son, this Stela, and there was a war with Canaan. And so what it says on this stone, the Israel Stela, and they call it the Israel Stela because it's one of the first times that they find any evidence of an Israel mentioned in Egypt. Canaan has been plundered into every sort of woe. Ashkelon has been overcome. Gezer, which is Gaza, has been captured. Yoam was made non-existent. And because it was made non-existent, nobody knows where or what Yoam was, because it was apparently completely destroyed. Israel was laid waste. Its seed is not. Now, wait a minute. This is Pharaoh's son reigning. He goes into Canaan. He conquers a good part of the Canaanite area, destroys these cities. Where was Israel? They were wandering out in the desert somewhere. They hadn't gone into Egypt. So how could Israel be in Canaan and settled at this time, and Egypt coming in and destroying the cities? That's a discrepancy. It does. Now, how did the archaeologists pass this on? He said, "Oh well, they were out there in Egypt. Egypt thought they were dead because they were wandering out in the desert. So Egypt thought they were all dead." You know, that's just kind of passing it off. But that doesn't really hold weight. There's that Stella. You can see the pharaohs up at the top there. And if you could read hieroglyphics, you could read all that stuff on the stone. Oh, I've seen a close-up of some of that, and it's still hard to read if you're right up there at it, because those stones kind of wear out after 2,000 or 3,000 years. Okay, so I want to wrap this up here and look at just a couple more slides. I want to show you the conventional dates that scientists, historians, archaeologists have come up with for the reigns of what's called the New Kingdom, which consists of two dynasties, the 18th dynasty and the 19th dynasty. And a dynasty is a the family lineage. Some point, basically, Judah had one dynasty because they all would go back to David. Israel, on the other hand, you know, Jeroboam, his son, ruled and so forth for a few kings down. Then somebody completely outside that family took over. And so there were a bunch of, you might say, dynasties of Israel. Only one of Judah because it stayed in the family. Well, same thing with the pharaohs. These dynasties would last for hundreds of years, passed on from son to from father to son to so forth. But then at certain points, and Ramses the First is one of these points, the dynasty changed. And so the 18th and 19th dynasties are called the New Kingdom. And you can see there, I've highlighted the dates, Ramses the Second. And if you look at the date 1479 to 1425, that's where the date of the Exodus falls, in the reign of Thutmose the Third. So maybe Thutmose the Third was the Pharaoh of the Exodus. But we've got all these discrepancies about Ramses. So if the Ramses date is off, could Thutmose's date be off in Egyptian chronology? See, so there are all these questions. But obviously Ramses, according to this conventional dates, is way too late to be associated with the Exodus. But the other problem is, if Thutmose III was the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Nothing else fits with what was going on in Egypt at that time. The new kingdom was the beautiful kingdom. The old kingdom, all the great pyramids, and I'm going to talk about this more next time, that was the monument kingdom. The new kingdom was the beautiful kingdom. The arts flourished. Literature flourished. There was peace. Egypt was strong. There was no indication of a collapse of Egypt after an exodus or something like that during the 18th or the 19th dynasty. So it just doesn't fit there. It doesn't meet the other criteria that we haven't got to yet on our checklist. Now, the archaeologist's conclusion is this. It's called the Copenhagen School. The Old Testament has no value as an historical source over the late 2nd or early 1st millennium B.C. in Palestine. In other words, forget the Bible. And that's what they say is that there is little or no tangible archaeological evidence to demonstrate the historical veracity of early biblical narratives. Okay, so that's the conclusion that science drew. But we see there's all these discrepancies. Things don't fit together. So should we just throw out the Bible? Or should we look elsewhere for a date of the Pharaoh at the time of the Exodus? You know, now, these historical anchor dates, what has happened is to get these anchor dates for Egyptian chronology, they've used this Shishank Shoshank, or the one and the same. And they can date that, but our unassailable anchor is the Bible. Now, we didn't have to use one of their anchors, Thebes, but our other anchors are all biblical. And so we need to then start looking at the question. We need to question the Egyptian chronology. So our conclusions, if Ramses was the Pharaoh of the Exodus, either the date of the Exodus based on the Bible is in error, or the conventional dates for the reign of the Pharaohs is in error. So either they're wrong or the Bible's wrong. How many vote that the Bible is wrong? I see no hands. No, we don't believe that, do we? So how was the Egyptian chronology developed, and is there evidence against it? Come back next week, and I'll tell you.